Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the toy department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, we are going to attempt the impossible on the toy department today. You excited for this, Matt Kolsky?
I'm always excited for an ambitious podcast attempt.
We have, like, I don't know, 17 items to discuss, and I have a ball game to get to, so plus a job to do. So
priorities, though.
So, yeah. So, basically, we're just trying to bend time and space. on this show.
That shouldn't be a problem.
Are you back at work, by the way?
Yep. Back at work. I was back at work last week. Trying to figure out what you do with a child when two parents are working. And yeah, that's the life I'm living now.
Is it challenging to do sports talk radio this time of year, or everybody's kind of set up on baseball?
There. No, it's hard. It's a hard job to write, especially when the breadwinning team in your market is awful.
Is not winning a lot of bread. Well, they were good for like 2 weeks, right? And
which almost made it worse because now you have people who think they're good and who are saying like, well, what's wrong now? And it's like, nothing's wrong now. Something went extraordinarily, shockingly right for 3 weeks or a month, and you were all misled about what your team was. Anyway, let's not do that here. I have to do that for 4 hours later.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, so we're going to talk about the new Quentin. I shouldn't say new now because I don't know. It feels like we're the last people maybe to talk about the Quentin Tarantino movie, but I'm still fired up to discuss it.
That just means we have a more considered perspective.
Indeed. And we've got a bunch of TV to get to. But I thought since we're sort of talking sports, you want to start with Hard Knocks?
Yeah, sure.
Caught the premiere last night, and I don't know what the process is for selecting the Hard Knocks team. I'm gonna guess HBO has a pretty heavy hand in it, but this is a hell of a good year to pick the Oakland Raiders. No,
oh yeah. Well, there are rules. Certain teams can't turn it down, but. You know, depending on, like, other teams can.
Right, everybody has to take a turn, right? Like, they haven't done the same team twice, have they yet?
They have done one team twice, I believe. Maybe the Bengals. But it was pretty far apart. And it's more than every team has to take a turn. It's like, if you have a new coach, you can turn it down. If you have, like, there's some circumstances in which they're like, all right, clearly you need to focus and not be on HBO.
Yeah.
But... other than that, it's HBO's choice. So HBO chooses, and then the team, for the most part, doesn't have an option to say no.
One of the things that I noticed was that the Raiders seemed very ready for HBO
for the
to show
cameras,
up.
You mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Like there's not a thing where you know, and maybe we'll talk about this some when we get into Bachelor in Paradise later. But like you know, sometimes you're on TV and you feel like people maybe don't notice the cameras are there, and they get used to the cameras are there. Like I felt like the Raiders were aware of the camera pretty much at all times.
Yeah, it certainly seemed like that. I mean, it's not to say no one's being genuine or anything, but. Certainly the guys we expected to be aware of the camera were right there. I mean, John Gruden knows where that thing is at all times. And Antonio Brown is, like, orchestrating events.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's zero chance he's rolling into camp in a hot air balloon if the HBO cameras are not there, right?
Correct. And I'm fine with that.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Because you know what both of those guys have in common, in addition to being elite attention seekers?
Please don't say they're grinders.
Well, I wasn't going to use that word, but they work their butts off.
Okay.
I mean, literally, the problem with Antonio Brown is they can't get him to stop trying so hard so he can heal himself.
Yeah.
And you can say what you want about his attitude or his cockiness or how he affects a locker room, but that dude wants to play and not only be great, but eviscerate everyone all the time.
Yeah.
And that is the kind of guy you want on your squad.
Yep. I mean, it was, you could, like, there was that sort of conversation with Gruden and Jonathan Abram where, you know, where he's trying to get Jonathan Abram to stop hitting people in their non-contact scrimmage.
Stop being an idiot, basically.
Yeah. Where you could tell that he liked that he had the kind of guy who just wanted to hit people in a non-contact scrimmage, but, you know, needed to find a way to get him to knock it off,
right.
Which I thought was a really, you know, interesting exchange. On the whole, by the way, you know, I found John Gruden to still be a complete goofball, but way, way, way more tolerable in this setting than the, you know, all those years of him in the booth.
Oh, I mean, I always liked him in the booth, so I don't. I have very few complaints about John Gruden as a personality.
And really, frankly, you're the guy, then I guess.
Yeah, I don't know why. Like, I honestly believe 30 years ago he's universally loved. Like, this is just. I think it's just our culture.
Ooh.
We can't tolerate anybody anymore.
Yeah, I'm a hard disagree on that. We don't need to get into that because that's a whole side thing. But yeah.
Okay, but you loved John Madden, right?
I did love John Madden, but the clear difference between the two for me is that John Madden was analysis with great shtick piled on top, and I feel like Gruden was 1,000% shtick. Just nothing but shtick.
I think it was pretty similar if you go back and look, but that's beside the point.
You know, there's also just, you know, John Madden was not aggressively trying to sell you the people in the game, which Gruden, you know, flat out say he was doing. But that's...
Yeah. But I also think he can't help himself. He just loves this stuff.
I think that's an act. But...
Well, I mean, look, it could be, but it's a weird way to spend your life if it's an act.
But it
right?
is. I will say, regardless of what you thought of him in the booth, it is weird how much him being able to curse really adds to my enjoyment of him.
Well, that and just I think it's one of these things. There are some people, especially in like the coaching world, I would say, where you have to be kind of a leader and motivator in addition to knowing your game. Where if you meet them or see them work, you just immediately get it.
Yeah.
Even if they're not great at what they're doing, you immediately get why everyone wants them to do it. The guy I always think of is Dusty Baker. Because I guess it's part of working in the field where I work, but more or less by coincidence, met and got to spend like an hour with Dusty Baker, hilariously, as he went from doing a, you know, 20-minute radio interview to like changing and putting on a suit for like a charity dinner or something. And it was just kind of a group of us chilling and chatting with Dusty. And it's just one of these things where, and at that time, I think he was already in Cincinnati. So like I had watched Dusty Baker fail as a manager repeatedly and get hired again. And I kind of always wondered, like, what is it with this guy?
Yeah.
And you immediately get it. He's just, he grabs the room. He's incredibly engaging. He makes you feel like listened to and, you know, cool. He's this electric, obvious leader, coach guy there's no doubt when he walks into a room to sell himself as a manager, everyone's on, you know, like everyone's hanging from his fingertips. He's just that good. And similarly, when you see Gruden give the speech at the beginning of the episode.
Well, the nightmare speech is a great speech.
Yes.
I knew he kind of had it prepared. It was a little canned, but he just crushed it.
Of course, but he crushed it.
Yeah.
And you're just like, oh, this is the John Gruden. This is head coach John Gruden that everybody freaked out about because they were like, what is this? He's perfect.
Yeah, this is the guy who was up for the Tennessee job every year.
Right, and obviously we know he's not perfect, and the team is far from perfect, but I get it. I sure get it, and it's fun to see that. That's one of the appeals to me of Hard Knocks is understanding what these guys can bring to the table.
Yeah, like when you sit here, when you see him say, like, we want to win and we want to win now, like, you believe it, even if you are well aware of the reality of the 4-12 Raiders last year.
Yeah.
Like in that moment, you believe it, which I think is
Look,
pretty neat.
they got me believing Richie Incognito is a new man. Like, it really, yeah. Hard Knocks is a drug, man.
It is. That was one of the things in my notes upset. I am not looking forward to more soft focused Richie Incognito rehab pieces, but.
No, me neither.
I'll probably fall for him.
That's the thing, is just like they'll convince you that a wide receiver who's going to end up taking 15 snaps is on his way to the Pro Bowl, they're going to convince you that Richie Incognito has gotten his life together and that, you know, John Gruden is the best coach in the league. Like,
well, it is instructive to sometimes remember that every single guy in the in the NFL. I'm not going to do the thing. But every single guy in the NFL is one of the absolute best in the world at what they do. That's how they got here, right?
Oh,
you sort of forget that. You know what I mean? So, like, when you're just watching them do stuff, you're like, oh, yeah, they're the guy's really good at doing stuff, you know? It's
honestly,
only in the context of the 30 other NFL teams that they look bad, right, you know?
Well, there's that. There's the fact that, like, when you watch Antonio Brown, someone working out at half speed has never been so impressive. You know, like, they're like, hey, could you just ease it back a little bit? There was that one scene
where the trainer's like, you don't even know that you're trying.
Right. Well, yeah. That was good. I love the way the trainer sort of tries to trick him into not hurting himself again.
Yeah.
But also the conversation with Gruden where he was like, hey, man, you know, basically Gruden was saying, I don't remember exactly what he said, but the message was you don't have anything to prove. Like, let's ease it back. We got to keep you healthy. And Antonio Brown was basically like, no, man, I gotta show these guys what's happening here.
Yeah, what I'm about, and, you know, lead by example.
And it's
all
like,
that.
Whether or not what he thinks is happening is actually happening in terms of the team, because I don't necessarily think it is, you gotta respect that.
You do. And it does sort of remind you, I think, too, that, like, you know, we talk about these guys, especially the wide receivers, you know, and their personalities based really on a very limited sample of who they are as people. Like,
correct.
We don't see what they're really like day to day, and we make some pretty huge assumptions about who they are based on that, right?
Well, and that's why it can be really nice, even though, again, we all know they know where the cameras are, and we all know everyone's on their best behavior with their family when they're being videotaped. Like, it warms the heart to see him playing with his kids, you know?
Yeah.
That scene where they're like, where's Roethlisberger?
Derek Carter?
No, Derek Carter. Yeah. And, like, I mean, I love that guy, Brown. I always have. He is one of – I mean, I think he's clearly the best receiver in the league when he's healthy right now, has been for several years. His numbers over the last five or six seasons are absolutely staggering. And I know there's some problems with the stuff he did in Pittsburgh, but also I'm not prepared to concede that he is a bigger problem than what's left in Pittsburgh those issues.
And look, I am all for guys trying to get their money. Like NFL players trying to get their money. I don't hold anything. Sit out a year if you want, man. You know, do what you got to do.
Did you see the picture of Antonio Brown's feet that was circulating on Twitter?
No.
Oh, God. Oh, God. Well, the report yesterday is that what happened really is he went into a cryotherapy chamber without appropriate footwear.
Ew.
And frostbit the bottoms of his feet.
Mm.
And there are internet photographs that, like, I don't know how he's walking, man.
Yeah, I don't want to see that.
No, you don't. I cannot recommend seeing it. I'm just telling you about it to make the point that, like, yeah, if you're going to frostbite your feet and train when you shouldn't and destroy your body overall, like, you damn well should get paid, especially when ultimately in an entertainment medium, you entertain as much as anybody anywhere.
I mean, these guys live 15 to 20 years less on average than a regular U.S. male. So,
yeah, man.
You know,
yeah.
Like, it's not a coincidence.
If Roethlisberger needs a football thrown in his face so you can get out of there, God bless.
Yep. We need to move on, but I did want to say before we go on this topic, shout out to Liev Schreiber, who does work as always. And I kind of feel like they may even be leaning on a little bit more this season than some seasons past. His narration is always on point. It's really good.
When they did the remix, the remix of The Autumn Wind, and Liev Schreiber was reading it, I was very into that.
Yeah. Yeah, you could tell. I think he was into it too.
The Autumn Wind is a pirate.
All right. You want to talk about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood? I've been waiting.
I really do to discuss this with you. I'm glad we had this time, not only so I could see the movie, but also so I could think about the movie.
Yeah. Did you absorb a lot of takes in between that? Because you know there are definitely takes out there.
I read almost no takes. I read a little bit about the reality, which obviously is tragically very different from the film. But
I'm almost jealous of you in that regard, because I do feel like a lot of people's takes were kind of this, well, what does he mean by this? And then that's a vehicle to just bring in all their own BS, you know, to whatever
what
their pet issue
this
is.
That's so funny to me, because this is so obvious. I know there has been some confusion. And one of the pieces of, I don't know if it's criticism, but of critical response that I took in was, well, this isn't a typical Tarantino movie. And I just don't know what these people have been watching for the last 20 years. I truly don't.
Well, I would say, it's definitely a typical Tarantino movie, but I would say
precisely,
that the ratio of talk to violence is maybe inverse to, you know, like, say, Inglourious Basterds or Pulp Fiction.
But the rest
of the elements are still the same.
Exactly. And if you have been watching 25 years of Quentin Tarantino movies going, a lot of violence, this is fun, and that's the only thing you've taken away, you are not a good viewer of Quentin Tarantino. And look, people on the streets can watch Pulp Fiction as a, you know, escapist action flick all they want and think that, you know, Inglourious Basterds is just an ultra violent, you know, meaningless pile. But the reality is, especially since he did Kill Bill, this is exactly what he does. He takes usually more general, but in this case a specific historical event, and writes basically his revenge porn fantasy of what should have happened, like in an admittedly vicious but generally right-minded world.
Yeah, and there's a love. It's infused with a love for old Hollywood. Both the films of old Hollywood, the city itself, you know, conventions of old media, like all those things are sort of recurring themes in his movies. Not to mention feet.
Sick sense of humor.
Yeah,
like a sick but righteous sense of humor. And I just thought this is just another and maybe you get to notice some of the craft more because it's a little less violent throughout. But again, the themes, the approach, what he's doing is unchanged, and I just think he's so damn good, man. I loved it. I loved it. And the more I think about it, the more I like it, and the more I want to see it again.
Yeah, the first thing in line in my notes is that QT is a fucking master, you know?
He really is. He really is just – who else is this good? I don't know. I really don't know the answer to that.
Yeah. I mean, I think you almost have to mention the casting because it's a showy casting, I would say. Like, there's a lot of crazy cameos and, you know, and big stars and whoa. But all of it, I think, is perfect. You know, like, there are just such a vivid array of really great secondary characters and cool actors and actresses popping up. And a lot of them really nail small parts. You know, Brad Pitt is ridiculously cool in this movie. I enjoyed the scene of him, you know, on the roof where, like, they just randomly have him take his shirt off. It's like a literal flex just to be like, yep,
when you
got it.
When you said, I enjoyed the scene, I knew that's where you were going.
Yeah.
Because Yeah, this is in many ways the role Brad Pitt was born to play almost at exactly this time. He like had to get to whatever. He's got to be like 60, which is remarkable. And he had to get there so he could be the like clearly weathered but still in incredible shape and the coolest dude you've ever. Well, 55, but still.
Yeah, but he's, this is like, yeah, it's a Steve McQueen-esque role for him, I feel like, you know what I mean?
And what's so great about this is that is the role.
Yeah.
The role is to be this cool. And I don't know that, to your point about casting, I don't know that anyone could have pulled it off like Brad Pitt. When you see him kick Bruce Lee's ass, like, if that's anyone else... I don't think it works.
I would like to see Pitt at some point. And this is, I would not say this is a flaw in the movie. It's just a thing I'd like for Brad Pitt's career. I would like to attempt to see him play someone who has some like real vulnerability. Like, I can't really think of a role where that's happened. He's been
probably like
not the coolest guy in the room and like Burn After Reading, you know what I mean? Or like,
right.
But he's never California. Really played a person who was like... I'm struggling.
True
like,
romance.
Yeah, true romance. Maybe. Yeah, maybe true romance. You're right. It's
well,
been,
he's
it's
not struggling.
Time.
I'm saying where he's not the coolest guy in the room.
Yeah,
romances.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Like I think like Leo's been able to do that at times. You know, like drug out of Leo, and in this movie, obviously, this guy's really like, you know, in his feelings a fair amount.
Yeah, it's pretty vulnerable. Yeah,
so, I wouldn't mind seeing that for Pitt at some point.
I think that's kind of true of Brad Pitt. That being said,
because I think he's a really good actor. You know,
he really, yeah. I mean, he might have kind of a lane, but he's played a lot of diverse stuff. Well, maybe if you go further back to like Legends of the Fall, River Runs Through It, there's some more vulnerability.
Yeah, you're right. I have kind of erased some of those movies because it's not in my alley.
Seven, you know.
What's in the box? Sorry.
He has. I mean, the career is. It's really unbelievable.
He's made some, you know, obviously he's been able to pick whatever he wants to do for a long time, but he has made some really interesting choices, I feel like, in the midst of
Oh,
that.
Yeah. He is not, you know, he projects as this sort of empty vessel hunk of a leading man, but he really clearly has made interesting choices. And I saw this at the Alamo Draft House.
Oh, that sounds delightful.
It was. So, you know, you get some fun. If you're there a little early, like movie facts and interesting anecdotes. And one of the things they put up was apparently for this movie, you know, early in the process, Brad Pitt showed up to Quentin Tarantino's house with like a old print of, I can't remember what the movie was now, but some old, very stunty, like pulpy, sort of, God, I wish I knew what the movie was, but there was like, it was like a tough guy thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where some, I think it was like the lead actor was like a former stuntman or something like that. And it was just a movie of him doing cool stuff and being a badass and beating people up. And Brad Pitt showed up like to Tarantino to be like, hey, I think this should be sort of a seed for this character. And Tarantino already had a 35 millimeter of the same movie, like on the projector, ready to show Brad Pitt. And just, you know, who knows how much of that story is precisely true. But my takeaway is certainly that here's a guy who is much more thoughtful about the process than you might imagine. Right. Like he's keeping up to some degree with Quentin Tarantino in like, check out this old flick that gives me some good ideas.
Yeah, and not to get into Brad Pitt love fest, but he's also a guy who's produced a lot of movies.
Yep.
So I think he probably has a pretty good sense of what needs to be done to get a set moving.
No doubt.
I loved the visual flair of this movie. I just thought L.A. looked amazing.
L.A. looks like the L.A. of Quentin Tarantino's fantasies in this movie.
Yeah. And so many of the characters looked amazing. The look of it was great. It's just a vivid, visceral experience. What did you think of the ending?
Tarantino talking about doing Reservoir Dogs and how, you know, making his first real movie, like, he didn't really know what he was doing in a lot of ways, and he knew what he wanted it to look like, but he didn't, and, you know, he ultimately trusted people he felt he could trust, but he was talking about the idea of, like, well, I know what it looks like in my head, but I don't know, I don't know specifically how to light this to make it look this way, or, you know, and I wasn't sure if it was going to look on screen like it looks in my head. And I think that's maybe the thing that stands out the most about how good he is now, is he clearly, this is what's in his head.
Yeah,
we are seeing a pretty precise vision of Quentin Tarantino's fever dreams or whatever.
Yeah, and even then, in those days, I think he had the ability to integrate music so seamlessly into the vibe of the whole thing, and I think that's also really really well displayed,
no doubt,
in this movie. I'm curious about what you thought about the ending, because obviously that's been a large part of the talk of this movie. Obviously, if you've gotten this far, we're spoiling the hell out of this.
I didn't take in a ton. I vaguely knew that the Sharon Tate murder was sort of the eye of the hurricane that he spun this story out of. But I didn't know what the ending was going to be until 10 minutes into the movie when I figured out what was happening here, and I was kind of waiting for it. Now, I didn't know exactly how it would happen, and of course it was spectacularly bloody, and it, I don't know if everyone takes it in, and I don't know if this is just something I happen to share.
Did you know that she was going to survive the film?
I imagined, once I got the lay of the land, you know, once she started showing up, and the narration was what it was, it occurred to me that in all likelihood, this movie was going to end with somehow the people who killed Sharon Tate being viciously murdered instead of Sharon Tate being viciously murdered.
Yeah.
Because that is, again, that is what Quentin Tarantino does. I watched Django Unchained and Inglourious Basterds, and this is his and even Kill Bill, to some degree, is a movie about what if, instead of how this always has happened, the people who ought to have survived and won and thrived do, and the people who actually did horrible things and you know, executed their disgusting plans in real life were instead the victims of horrible violence. So that ending had occurred to me, but it did not. If anything, it made me more excited because I was on the edge of my seat waiting to see how this would play out the whole time. And I found the ending just as satisfying as when the slave master is viciously beaten in Django and as when the Nazis are brutalized in Inglourious Basterds. I enjoy the revenge fantasies that Quentin Tarantino draws.
Yeah, I mean, look, there was a little part of me that's you know, queasy about not just someone like, you know, flame broiling a person, but flame boiling a woman. And I know that we're talking about murderers, but it still is a little bit weird when there's like this like super intense male female violence.
And I think, look, that's a fair criticism. Quentin Tarantino has been criticized for that. And I think, you know, his frequent violent treatment of women and his strange obsession with the N-word have been probably the two most aggressive criticisms of him. But for my money, I think, and I know you're not making a harsh criticism in that
way. I didn't even necessarily consider it a criticism. I was just saying it made me uncomfortable.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
No, but you're aware that those are probably the primary criticisms of him. And I really think they miss the point.
Yeah.
Because the point, it doesn't matter. There's some dangerous both sides stuff that I don't want to do here, but it's the way I feel about this particular director is there's not a sexist bone in that. If anything, it's anti-sexist. Why shouldn't a woman murderer be just as flamethrowable as a male murderer? She's a horrifying individual who committed a heinous crime in the real world, and I really don't see the problem with lighting her a fire in the fake world. Yep. I just don't see the problem with it at all.
Happy to see my girl from Better Things, by the way, getting a plum role.
Oh, man. And she has that thing. Amanda Seyfried is the other person I think of that, like, with something about her eyes and the way they sit in her face.
Yeah.
She's just mesmerizing.
Haydn had a theory, and he wrote about this, that actually made a lot of sense to me, which is that the ending is really a product of Brad Pitt's acid trip. That, right? Because, you know, the acid dip cigarette really appears to be, you know, kind of a Chekhov's gun sort of situation, right?
Absolutely a like, Chekhov's gun. Like, yeah, you're just waiting. That's another thing. Yeah. As soon as you see the acid dip cigarette, you're like, okay, something crazy's going down.
Right. And so at the moment when, you know, their friendship is necessarily dissolving, his employment is necessarily dissolving, he's sort of wondering what to do with his life. He's, you know, tripping balls. And then he then somehow imagines this scenario in which not only are he Leo's character, whose name is escaping me right now. One's Cliff, right?
Richard Dalton. Yeah.
Where they're the heroes and they save everybody. But also, you know, everyone just happens to be a big fan of Rick Dalton and his work, right? You know what I mean? And then he gets the invite to the Polanski's that he had always desired, and then maybe has a career, and then maybe Brad Pitt still has a job. You know what I mean? So that it does sort of, it could be this kind of like Brad Pittian fantasy that never happened, and instead those people really went over to Sharon Tate's house and murdered her in cold blood. You know what I mean?
That is a great theory. I love it, and it just increases my enjoyment of this film.
Yeah, it does too. What is the acid dip cigarette really doing in the movie? It didn't contribute to the finale other than that, essentially, right?
Yeah, I mean, other than him being that much more of a badass because he's all hopped up on goofballs while he's whooping these people's asses.
And Brad Pitt's acid fantasy is a world where it makes more sense that Rick Dalton would actually get to take home the flamethrower from the movie set.
Totally. No, I really like that theory. Yeah. I had not heard or thought of that, and I like it a lot. And again, like, I want to, you know, I go back to the Sopranos finale as a example of as a creator, don't ask me to do your job. It galls me to no end. Like, I don't want to do your job, but if you do your job and there are multiple interpretations, that just means you've done a better job to me.
Yeah.
It's a fine line, right? But to me, when you turn out the lights in the middle of the final scene of your show, you've stopped doing your job too soon. When you present a multifaceted, twisty ending that could result in different interpretations, you've hit a home run.
Yeah, look, I like ambiguity, which is why I'm okay with the chase ending and this ending. But that's, the story for another day. I think for me, I'd come into
well,
it's
just different kinds of ambiguity is the point I'm making.
Understanding it was going to be long, expecting it was going to be long. I was caught a little bit off guard by the ending because I just sort of assumed that Sharon was going to die because that's what happens in real life, which was probably dumb on my part. But anyway, it did caught me off guard. And I felt like, oh man, I could watch another hour of this. which I think is just a testament to how entertaining the whole thing was.
Yeah, I mean, I looked at my watch and was shocked, and I looked up the running time, and it's 160 minutes.
Yeah,
and it was the fastest 160 of my lifetime.
Supposedly, there may be a full longer cut that comes to Netflix at some point.
I did see that because you tweeted about it, and I. Just like you, I would absolutely be here for that because, again, like, I don't think this should be that controversial. Everyone who is even close to as obsessed with television as us has spent multiple days in the past several years where they've sat in front of a television and watched 4 or 5 hours of a TV show in a row.
Yep.
And I trust Quentin Tarantino to entertain me just as long as that.
For sure.
So if there's a four-hour version of this, I believe it'll be an excellent 4 hours of television entertainment. Like, I'm not worried. At this point, I trust this man completely with my movie going.
Yeah, and I also feel like it's 5 years at a minimum, right? Probably before we get another one. So I'll go save her all I have. You know what I mean?
You know what? I think if there's a takeaway from that, it's that it takes about 5 years to make a masterpiece.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's the game. And maybe if more people took 5 years to make their movies, like, who are the best people making movies in Hollywood right now? Because two jump to my mind right away, and they both take about that long to make a movie.
That's true.
And it's Paul Thomas Anderson and Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, and that's sort of their style. It's interesting that who are the best people in Hollywood making movies. Like, you got to talk about the Mexican trio, I would assume. And then you've, and those two guys. And
very few of those guys have movies coming out more than every few years.
Yeah, it's true.
Unfortunately, not women on that list based on opportunity. But, the best directors are the ones who, A, are given the opportunity to take the time and, you know, devote that level of attention to the precision of movie making, and they don't push it. Really great ones don't push it.
God, that's another story for another day. And particularly given how much great TV has been made and directed by women like these last few years, like the fact that more women are not getting shots to make movies is ridiculous and sad. You know,
it is yet another shocking way that this country is disappointing.
Yeah. Indeed. All right. Let's move into TV. Dear White People.
Pick up the pace, or we're not going to get to any of this stuff.
Yeah. Dear White People's back.
This show is almost deliberately jumping the shark in some ways.
Well, there's a lot of Netflix shade in the first couple episodes. Well,
but it's Netflix shade, but it's also self-referential, like self-deprecating humor, right? I mean, they seem to have acknowledged that the only reason to keep making this show is that it's good, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And that might seem like a dumb thing to say, like what better reason is there to keep making a show? But I think, like, this show is not necessarily saying new stuff. It's just continuing to say the same stuff hilariously and with style, right?
I would agree with that. I do think that it seems like there's sort of a ever-expanding ensemble here, and I'm not sure that they really have enough for everyone to do.
Yeah, I think that's very fair.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And not only do you look, this is universal. I think, you know, I know we spend a lot of time on the like super critical reactions to Game of Thrones, but like the average reaction, I think, is more just what's going on here? Who is that? I say this just to say that I think any show at a certain point, like, you just start to lose track when you have too many characters.
Yeah.
And there are definitely some characters. I only watched two episodes, but there were a few times where someone popped up and it was like, oh, so-and-so, we know you, and yada, yada. And I was like, wait, what? I forget.
Yeah. Like,
what's happening here?
Like, there's more people like coming, you know, like the girl that worked with Lionel on the paper, like, has a much bigger role this season. You know, there's a lot, you know, a lot of sort of characters from the gay community or at school are introduced, and sort of emphasized.
And of course, is it Giancarlo Esposito? Is that his name?
Yeah.
Making, more and more appearances.
Right. And then there's, I don't think you've gotten really much Blair Underwood, but he pops up.
Nope, I have.
Later on.
Yeah. Episode 2, he's pretty prominent, as the returning professor. And everyone has a storyline, and it's a lot, but I continue to think this is just good TV.
Yeah, it is good TV. I really enjoy some of the quick pop culture references too. Like, and some of them are really like crazy and obscure. Like, one of the ones I read that was like obtainable Daniel Sunjata, which is like a super specific reference. Or like, you know, the quick jokes about Elizabeth Moss being a Scientologist.
Yep.
The entire Hunger Games parody is fantastic.
Handmaid's Tale.
Handmaid's Tale,
yeah,
sorry.
It
yeah.
is. Honestly, I am. I got Dear White People'd a little bit because it makes some points about The Handmaid's Tale that I had not necessarily considered that I now feel moderately ashamed for not having considered.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
In a funny way, but like nevertheless, I mean, there's that scene where they're watching it and God, I'm not going to do it justice, but they just say some things about, you know, basically they do the sort of formulation of, you know, must be nice essentially for The Handmaid's Tale,
yeah.
just versus being a person of color in real America. And I kind of was like, oh God, I hadn't thought of that, but that is a little bit.
Yeah. I also really enjoyed the African exchange students talking about
yes.
the peanut butter cups. He's like, you separate yeah. your people, but you mix your foods. which was just really like, yeah, there's some really fun, still funny moments on the show.
Yeah. And so if you're the sort of person that, you know, thinks the world is going to hell in a handbasket, but would prefer to laugh about it than cry about it, this is for you.
Yeah. I assume that some people must be watching the show because Netflix seems fairly quick to cancel things now when people are not, and we're in season 3. But it's not a show I hear a lot of people talk about, so I do hope if you haven't ever checked it out that you do find it, because especially the early seasons have a lot to say, and it's just entertaining.
I think you and I are pretty in at this point, and this is just spending time with a thing we like, but those first two seasons I really think were pretty brilliant, so I can't recommend them strongly enough.
Yep. Did you find Black Lady Sketch Show to be really brilliant?
No, I don't like... I have a really high standard for sketch, and honestly, I thought this had a much higher hit rate than any Saturday Night Live that I've seen in the last 20 years, but there's too much smiling, not enough laughing for me with shows like this, and it's not, like, they're all really funny. I especially like, is it Quinta?
I'm not sure.
Short, curly-haired
Oh,
one.
Yeah. I did like her, though.
Quinta Brunson, yeah. I'm a big fan of her, and I'm like Ashley Nicole Black. Like, I thought Robin Thede was really funny. Maybe my favorite sketch was her, sort of like infomercial style, pro African sort of snake oil saleswoman.
Yeah, that was good.
That was really funny. I thought the sort of intercut scenes where it's just them playing themselves, hanging out, and then, spoiler alert, you realize they're in a post-apocalyptic world at the very end of the episode.
Yeah.
Like, that got me at least to a point where I would consider watching it again to sort of see where some of this stuff goes, because it does seem like it's one of those sketch shows where we're going to get threads through the episodes with sketches returning. And like I recognize good writing and I enjoyed certain scenes, but sketch shows are tough for me, man.
Yeah. It's funny. Look, it's hit and miss, you know, and I think back to like, as you're talking about this and like Threads, like I really enjoyed like Kroll Show.
Right. Yeah. I couldn't get into it.
And I really loved the way that, you know, those, especially like as it went on, those threads really, really built up and the show referenced itself over time. But like, if you're watching, you know, kind of like you did, if you're watching any one episode of that show, like some of those sketches work and some of them do not, you know? And so, yeah, like it can be a lot to sit through.
Yeah. I'm just not sure there's a way around that.
Yeah.
And as someone who grew up in Chicago, seeing a lot of sketch, I have to say that feels fine to me, even good at a live show. 'Cause there's this very DIY feel, and it's like, you know, you win some, you lose some, makes sense. But on TV, it, you know what it is? Here's a weird analogy for you. I feel about sketch shows on television sort of the way you feel about jam bands.
Mm.
Like, I
that
know,
makes sense to me, actually.
Yeah, because in our conversations, you have said, like, finish it, and then I'll listen to it, basically.
Mm.
You know? Like, sure, I can dig a guitar solo at a live show, but, like, I want the best version of your best song on the record.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that's what I'm looking for in music. And I think that, to some degree, is how I feel about sketch comedy. Like, I get it. I get that this is the process. I get that with experimentation and, you know, comedic sort of reaching, you're going to have some times where you fall on your face. And I understand that. And it's not critical of the performers or writers so much as it's just not for me.
Yeah, fair enough. I will probably watch more of this, but this is not like a must see.
Like as a comparison. I don't dislike Curb Your Enthusiasm, but I preferred watching the finished product, which I call Seinfeld.
You know okay. What I mean? Yeah, no, I get that. That's fine. Let's move to Bachelor in Paradise because I'm kind of dying to hear your take on this. As someone who was a definite real fan of Love Island, and not so much a fan of the Bachelor franchise. How does this version, which has I feel like a lot more of the elements of Love Island, compare for you? Now I also feel like we should say you've seen a kind of one and a half, two of these, right? I only saw one.
Yeah.
I only saw the premiere. So
yeah, and the premiere was a settling in, and I started to get worried. Like, God, I don't know who any of these people are.
Yeah, that's.
Am I going to enjoy this?
They do plenty of catch up for you, and it doesn't really matter.
It doesn't matter at all.
Yeah.
They're psychos, and almost everything that's going on is based around stuff they've done off camera over the last 4 months.
Right.
So, like, they're psychopaths, and that's what you want for reality TV is, like, megalomaniacal psychopaths. And you're right. This pokes all the same funny bones as Love Island, and it's a delight for me. I will say, this might be the tip of the spear in me, like, forcibly cutting back on reality television, because it goes so it's even more ridiculous than Love Island, unbelievably.
Yeah, because these people are willing to play along with all the setups. You know what I mean?
So craven. These people are so nakedly, cynically craven. But they also clearly are emotionally destroyed by each other on a regular basis, and like I think we've talked about this in the past when we've watched some of these love-based reality things, like if you are willing to go on television and pretend like you're there to find love and then savage people from an emotional perspective, I feel absolutely justified in laughing at your pain. So you know, and I didn't quite finish the second episode. I was up very late last night and knew I'd be woken early this morning. But when the whole sort of arc of the first two episodes is built around a dude who slept with two chicks who were there on back-to-back nights at a music festival like a month before this started and then told one of them not to tell anybody about it and thought he was friends with the other one, and then they're both there like calling him out and talking about him behind his back and then confronting him, and like he's crying. You know, all these people are such an apocalypse. Yeah. That
by the way, his reputation on the show previous to this was he was like the nice sensitive guy.
Well, what's funny is I don't know what he is, because like the way he this is going to get me in trouble. The way he describes it, I kind of get it, how he might not have thought he was being a dirty, dirty whore. But part of that, I think, also is just everyone is turning on him in such an overdramatic way that I'm like, all right, come on. Like, you're all a bunch of messes on an island making out with each other. Yeah. one of
the plus the pressure is like, I mean, right? You could become a villain to like every woman in America, really, right? If things turn on you the wrong way, right? Because all the sisters are siding with the sisters. You know what I mean?
And you didn't watch any of episode two, but when he realizes what's happening, and he realizes what they're saying about him and how they feel about the situation, you can just watch the realization of that dawn on him. That, yeah, like, oh my God, I didn't just piss off two women. I pissed off every woman on this island and likely 50% of women in this country. And you can just see him spiraling like, oh no, this is so bad. And he keeps going, oh no. And he's crying. And like, I get that I probably sound like a creepy sadist right now. But again, they signed up for this like a bunch of dumb attention whores.
Yep.
And they deserve what they get. So I'm going to laugh at their pain and not feel bad about it until I realize I've spent, you know, 6 hours of my life watching stupid people make out for over the last 5 days.
It is a lot of time, man. 4 hours a week is a lot to ask.
It's too much. I think it's just too much.
It definitely. And by the way, this is one of the reasons why I didn't watch it last night. Like, it's a definite DVR show. You need to be able to have access to the fast forward when
they repeat themselves so much.
Yeah, you cut out all the montages and previews and all that stuff because it is. Yeah. Every episode's also larded.
The part of the problem for me is, like, I'm not a pro, so I don't know exactly when to press the skip forward button.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, like, I end up seeing most things twice because that's just how these shows work.
Yeah. Oh, especially if there's a drama thing, you may see it three or four times. You know, but yeah, the show is openly laughing at the people in it half the time, which I think is great.
One of my favorite things that I think sort of like is a tremendous microcosm for the idiocy that's happening here is, I forget who, it might have been Clay, the former NFL player, who's also in some drama, by the way, but and who I have no idea who he is, but I believe it was him when he walked on. And, you know, there's like five people there before him who've been there for what seems like, I don't know, maybe 2 hours. And he's like, all right, so what's happened so far?
Yeah.
And somebody was like, you know, surprisingly, really no drama yet. And I'm like, you've been there for 2 hours. What drama was supposed to happen? And then, of course, in the next 2 hours, there's like epic drama.
Yep. You know what's sort of amazing is that The Bachelor in Paradise has actually produced more marriages than the Bachelor and the Bachelorette, and definitely more children.
You know what's funny about that is I think it's probably a better way. Like if you're really there for the right reasons, which is of course always in debate.
Yeah.
But like, okay. How are you more likely to find a sincere connection? By speed dating 30 people and never really getting to spend much time with anyone? Or by being thrown into an isolated environment where you're actually forced to spend
lots of,
you know, quote-unquote quality time with a whole bunch of people? I think you probably get to know people better in this environment. Yeah, you're getting, like, the drunk version, but in some ways that's just speeding things up. And you also get to like, at a certain level, being a slut, and I use that word non-judgmentally and ungendered, but being a slut is just taste testing potential meals, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's probably not the best way to go about it, but it probably is somewhat efficient.
Yeah, and look, and I think you also, the part of that you left out in terms of just being isolated on this island, spending time with a group of people, is that there's also a large contingent of producers who are manipulating things to, you know, make you come together, whether it's, you know, these date cards or just suggestions or, you know, all sorts of other things. This show is, and this is, to me, like, this is kind of why I prefer it to maybe Love Island, is I just think it's so masterfully produced, like, that these people really understand how to manipulate these people. And since it's everyone has already done a season of The Bachelor or more, in some cases 6 seasons, they also understand how to be manipulated, you know, like, so it kind of, it really sort of works both ways, you know?
Well, and I think, you know, it's also one of these things of like, in as much as this is a narrative TV world, right? That the Bachelor is a world of television like any other world, you know, not so different from the world of Black-ish that has spun off into three or four different sitcoms now, right? Where like, this is sort of, yeah, it's reality, blah, blah, but it's really not that different from like a created world where a bunch of characters we know live. And so they are now choosing for Bachelor in Paradise, they get to choose from established characters who they can predict interacting in various ways, which has to be an advantage for the producers.
Yeah, for sure. We probably need to move on because I got a bug in to get to, but I do. I'm really happy that you're enjoying the show.
Yeah, I don't know if I can hang with it because it's just a lot.
It is a lot. I get it. Particularly if you're still trying to watch Love Island. I don't know if that's a thing in your life or not. But
yeah, I mean,
is that still on?
The good news about Love Island is I think this is the last week of it.
Okay.
It's just like 3 or 4 weeks, wham, bam, make a couple, move on. So that'll be over soon, and then maybe I'll find my love of Bachelor in Paradise again.
Yeah, and this one, the Bachelor in Paradise also lasts, I think, less time than the regular Bachelor or Bachelorette does as well. It's just a better version of it. I'm kind of – this is probably the one I'm sticking to. This last season, I guess, of the Bachelorette apparently did really well.
But you didn't love it.
But I was out. Yeah, I just didn't.
Yeah.
I haven't cared for the people that they've cast in the leads the last few years. And this is just that kind of makes us all not a problem.
You know? Right.
It also,
there is no lead.
This show is way more diverse, I think, in general than a lot of times the Bachelor franchise can be. It's not super diverse.
It is a diverse cast. and they can make the main character whoever is entertaining at any given moment.
Yeah. So anyway, let's get to homework because we have a fair amount of that to talk about as well.
Don't we have a fair amount of things we did not cover just now?
Just now, I think. Oh yeah. No! Oh shit! Well, we didn't talk about Whitney Cummings. That's the only thing I could tell that we missed. Do you want to hit that real quick? I don't have a ton to say about Whitney. It was a fine special. It didn't knock me out. I definitely appreciated the links it took to go to that robot Whitney joke, and then the montage they did at the end where they kind of actually show you those links was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought – so, look, I like Whitney as a comedian. I don't think she's one of the top 10 or anything like that, but she's funny. She has a very specific perspective that she's very good at expressing, and the robot Whitney bit was it's not like I'm thinking like, man, you know, it's the Eddie Murphy Goony Goo Goo bit and the Whitney Cummings robot bit and everybody else is no, but it was really funny. And not it sounds like similarly to you, I appreciated the lengths she went to for the bit. Commitment to the bit is a thing that helps, and that was here for sure.
Yeah.
And just overall funny and thoughtful in its own way, and had some things to say, and not spectacular, but if you're into stand-up comedy, you should watch it.
I almost thought she was funnier in the scenes that they show her just kind of hanging around setting up the robot thing than in a lot of the special.
It's funny you say that, because you know what I was very clear to me from just in general, always has been, but especially from watching those scenes, is like, you understand why she's had so much success as a television show creator, because I can just picture how great she'd be in a writer's room.
Yep.
You know, she seems like someone who, like, just riffing and bouncing ideas is just hilarious.
Yeah, I think she also seems to just sort of have the right perspective to make a television show from. So
yeah. She can go big picture on it very, very in a way that makes a lot of sense, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure there's something that I must have forgot to write down, but that is all the things that I wrote down. So
no, I think you're right. We did it. It not unlike Quentin Tarantino's masterpiece Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, it was smoother and went faster than I imagined.
Yeah, there you go. All right, so homework. Tonight is the premiere of the Beverly Hills 90210 revival, which is titled BH90210. Yeah. And it's supposed to be a little bit meta. It's starring the original cast. Now, I can't tell if we mentioned this on the pod or in the pre-show meeting. You are not a 90210 watcher.
I almost have seen none of it. I mean, I'm aware of some of the cultural touchstones, but I basically haven't watched it at all. And I don't know what that will do to my enjoyment of this one. As you've pointed out, it should have been right in my wheelhouse, but I'm both a little too young and wasn't allowed to watch TV as a small kid. So I missed some of that stuff.
It's like sui generis of like almost of a lot of things that you really love. So I But who knows what this version of it's going to be like, you know what I mean?
Right. Cuz they're old now, and the version I loved, the version of what I love is like teenage melodrama.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, Euphoria, holy Moses.
Oh yeah, we should probably talk about that next week.
Yeah. Yeah, might be a little late, but some time to ruminate might not be the worst thing. I don't know what it's going to be. If it's just a bunch of references to the first time around, it's probably not going to work for me. But on the other hand, I think it has an opportunity to be funny and play with some of the tropes of the genre, and we'll see.
Yeah, from what I've heard, that is the direction it is leaning in. So
the funny direction?
Sort of meta playing with the, you know, and that's sort of the reviews are referencing that.
All right. Well, I'm interested to see. We'll see how it goes.
Talk about, you know, post fame and things like that. So, all right. So that's tonight. Glow is back, which I couldn't be more thrilled about. Succession.
Samesies. Yeah.
And then same for Succession, you know, which we loved last year. And then you were a huge fan of Lodge 49.
I was.
And that returns this weekend as well. I don't really remember where I left off with that, so that could be an interesting experience for me. I'm sure I'll find out when I tune back in.
I expect you'll get a first season recap at the beginning.
Yes, I will be very hard in on the previously on Lodge 49 section.
Yeah, it's a weird little show, but I really liked it.
All right. First pitch of the baseball game supposed to be out, I think, is happening right now. So I'm going to...
Oh, bro. Sorry. You better get out of here.
It's okay. I knew I was going to be there for the beginning. And you know, baseball games are very long, as it turns out.
They sure are.
Particularly when they involve an American League team and a DH and all that stuff. So.
Woof. Why don't you head over to Target Field, and we'll talk in a week. Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling, and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.